Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Bob Dodds of Las Vegas, Nevada. He was a baby-faced 17-year-old on the subtender USS Pelias at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
You know, I think of what we know now and what probably, you know, a lot of people who weren't born yet have heard, you know, that this awakened a sleeping giant. And we've heard, you know, remember Pearl Harbor and that refrain throughout the nation. But for you there, in the days after this attack, having the morbid duty that you had to carry out, how did it make you feel about the Japanese or about what was going to happen next?
Well, it was doubly hard for me. The reason it was doubly hard for me because I went to school with a lot of Japanese kids in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. There was Satsuma, Ken Soda, a bunch of guys that I went through grade school with, junior high school, and into high school. They were all friends of mine. Of course, they went to Japanese school. After they finished school, they went to Japanese school. And their parents had the markets, the fruit and vegetables at Safeway store. They raised a lot of stuff along the coast. And it was hard for me to figure out any of them kids that I knew doing something like this to people like me. So it was I couldn't really figure out why they would want to attack us. I mean, because I didn't know a lot of what was going on in Washington until
sure.
After this is over. I always honor those people because they were hardworking. They did jobs that nobody else wanted to do, and they were good at it. They were very good in school. I really liked the Japanese people. I liked those kids I went to school with. I knew their parents, too. So it was hard for me, doubly hard.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, as you're out there fighting this war, a lot of them got locked up back in California with their families and then volunteered to fight for the country that was locking them up.
They never had a chance to do that until later.
Right.
There was no question. They gathered them up without any questions at all. And that bothered me because they took their house. They took their savings. They took their life away from them. I'm sure that if Ken Soda or Satsuma, some of the kids I went to school with, were offered at that time to go maybe fight in Europe, they probably would have jumped at the chance. But that didn't happen until later on.
Yeah, they were denied. They were told they couldn't. They were enemy aliens.
Yep.
Yeah. You stay on the Pelias all the way to Australia. Mm-hmm. Why'd you leave the ship? It had been pretty good to you. What's the deal?
Well, I got transferred to new construction. That was the idea. And I got on the Gold Star, and they shipped us around the southern part of the island, and they pulled into Brisbane. Supposedly, we were going to go back to the States for new construction. However, what they were doing was bringing ships over with short crews and taking the guys who had lost ships and putting them on there. And instead of sending us all the way back to the ship, they just put us on the ship.
All right.
So what happened in Brisbane, there was a ship there. I think it was a mail boat or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it wasn't a war-type ship anyway. And they put us on there. There was four of us. There was Robbie the Gunner, Dick Marotta, Bobby King, and me, four of us. So they assigned us to the Monson. So I said, well, where the hell is the Monson? Well, we're going to take you there. So I can't remember if we went to Noumea or New Caledonia. I'm pretty sure it was Noumea. When we got there, we loaded our sea bags, got aboard ship, and they were getting underway. So we gave our records to the officer of the deck as we climbed the ladder, handed him our records, and they said, well, go below and stow your gear and stay in the berthing compartment. Well, they were at GQ, the task force was leaving Noumea, and they were heading out. I looked at Bobby King, who was a third-class gunner, and I said, boy, that's a hell of a welcoming. We don't even get to go to the personnel office. We don't get anything. We haven't even eaten yet. So Dick Marotta and Bobby King, there were a couple reserves. Well, I knew I shouldn't have joined the Navy, blah, 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 blah. And I said, shut up, because Robbie and I were regular Navy. Those were reserves.
Uh-huh.
So we stayed down there till we got to port. So we went up on the bridge, and the officer of the deck says, well, we don't have any billets for you, so what are you? And I said, well, I'm a bosun mate. Okay, you're not part of a gun crew, so we're going to put you as bosun mate of the watch. And you, the bosun mate of the watch, you get on in the number one mound up there in a 5-inch gun. So I'm on the bridge. So Dick Marotta and Bobby King were both engine men, so they needed somebody on the emergency generator, so they put them there. And Robbie was a third-class gunner's mate, so he knew about guns and everything, so they put him on the aft 5-inch gun. So we get up to Guadalcanal, at least that's where we were heading, this task force. And we were doing some firing on the way. Ships or planes were flying. I was firing on the way up on the bridge. And I don't even know anybody. I don't know a soul on that bridge. So anyway, make a long story short, they sent, I think it was two cruisers and a carrier. And I think it was six destroyers, I think. And I think the Aaron Ward was one of them, the Bushnell and the Monson. So they know the Japanese fleet is coming down. And that's why we're sent out to stop the reinforcement of Guadalcanal and Tulagi, because they were going to split the force. They were going to drop troops at Guadalcanal and also reinforce the troops at Tulagi. Now, the Marines were at Tulagi, and the Army and Marines were at Guadalcanal. So the first thing that happened, there's a Sable Island. It's a passage on each side of Sable Island. So what the task force commander did was split the group and send some this way and send some this way to catch either way they went.
Sure.
Well, we got the bulk of them. So the first thing happened.
You got the wrong side of the coin.
We got the wrong side of the coin that time.
And this is November of 1942.
Yes. It's about, I don't know, around 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night.
All right.
And all of a sudden, searchlights come on. It's the Japanese shining searchlights on us. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, this ain't us. And we're not good. I'm on the bridge. Well, the first thing hit turret, the gun mount, number 5-inch gun mount, and blew it up. It was gone. Something, a torpedo hit midships or somewhere along midships on the port side. And the next one hit the bridge. Well, at the time it hit the bridge, I was back in the chart room trying to look and see what the heck was going on with the chart because I didn't know what was going on. Well, it killed everybody on the bridge. So I was how did I miss that?
How long ago had you been there? Just minutes?
Yeah.
Minutes before you're on the bridge. If you're still there, you're gone.
Yeah.
But for some reason, you're back in that chart room.
I went back in the chart room. And it did blast the door open, the watertight door. It did break the seal on it. But I went back out. There was one guy still moving. And he says, we got to abandon ship. We got to abandon ship. So I thought, whoa. So I tried passing a word over the speaker system, abandon ship. It didn't work. It was out. It's gone.
You get on the microphone and it's dead.
It's dead. So I thought, well, hell with this. I'm getting out of here. So I went down and I went back aft. I found Robbie. He was climbing out of the rear mount back there because he knew the ship had been hit and was listing. And I got the Bobby King and Dick out of there. And I said, let's get the hell off here because they're going to abandon ship. So we were back aft on the starboard side. So I said, the freeboard is really not too low. It's short, maybe 4 or 5 feet, something like that.
All right.
So I said, let's go over here because we get off because the ship was listed to that side.
It's listing and it's burning, right? I mean, there's fire everywhere.
Oh, yeah. So we go over the side back aft. So we're in the water and other ships, lights are going on there. Everybody's shooting. A couple of ships run into each other. It was a mess. So anyway, we're all four in the water. And I said, look, got to swim. Got to get away from this because that ship goes down. It's going to pull us in. So we swam and got away from it. We've had a little bit of a pull, but not enough to bother us. So we're in the water. So Dick says, we got to swim. I said, where? It's dark. Where? He says, well, there's got to be land someplace. I said, well, there is. Maybe it's 30 miles away. Maybe it's 100 miles away. Maybe it's only 2 miles away. I'm staying right here. And he says, what about sharks? I said, I'm not worried about sharks. I'm worried about getting run over by another ship, chew us up in the props. So what we got to do is stay together, stay here. So they said, well, we'll swim. I said, go for it. Robbie and I stayed together. So they took off a little bit. Pretty soon they come back and says, maybe you're right. So the next morning, the daylight's coming, and here comes a ship. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I hope this is one of ours. Well, it was a mine layer or mine sweeper. So they pick us up. I heard them say they got us all aboard. Well, this is all there is. There's just four of them. So I naturally assumed that everybody's dead. Four of us are alive. And I said, what are you guys doing? Well, we're laying mines here because they're expecting the Japanese to land troops on this because it's Japanese held. So we're laying mines to stop them from landing on the beach here. And I looked at Dick and I said, now, dummy, how do you feel now? If we'd have swam to the beach, that was Japanese territory. How do you feel now, you stupid jerk? I was really mad at him. Both of them. I said, damn reserves. You don't even got any brains at all. You ought to be back selling shoes. I was just really upset. And he kept bringing that up all the time, every time we had got together. Says, you still think I ought to be selling shoes? But anyway, they picked us up and embedded us with the Marines on Tulagi because they were fighting in Tulagi. However, later on, I find out there was about 100 and some guys that actually survived. picked up on the port side by other ships and taken to Guadalcanal and embedded with the Army over there. So they put us with the Marines and had us loading ammo and stuff like that. That's what we were doing for the Marines.
So how long were you in the water?
Overnight, from about probably midnight till 7:30, maybe 8 o'clock. I don't know what time exactly, but it was late morning for us, because Reveille's usually at 6, so it was definitely after 6 o'clock. So.
That's a lot of time to be in the water. Did you have something to hold on to stay
afloat?
Oh,
we had life jackets.
You had your May West?
Yeah. They were oil-soaked, full of oil and everything, but they worked. And the shark repellent packets, they had gone. We didn't have any shark repellent packages. Usually you have a little bag, attached to them, and a little flashlight. We didn't have that, which I'm glad, because them jerks would have probably had a flashlight or something like that. So.
Did you see any sharks?
Well, later on, yeah. I'd seen barracuda and sharks, yeah. After when we were in Tulagi, they had built a dock, so boats could get into the dock there. The Beachmaster had a dock built. And you go down there at night and shine a light in the water, and you'd see all these barracuda and sharks, little baby sharks swinging around there, yeah.
So they may have been around you this whole time, but you couldn't see them while you're in the water.
But then
seeing that later, you said, boy, I'm glad I didn't see them.
Yeah, that's right. That was an experience.
Was there any point in those 7 hours where you thought, I don't know if anyone's going to find us? I don't know if we're ever going to get out of this?
Oh, I knew I was going to get out of it.
How'd you know?
I just knew. Some way I'm going to get out of this. I'm not going to die here. I'm going to get out of this. Some way I'm going to make it. Now, maybe you guys ain't going to make it, but I'm going to make it.
And when you say you knew you were going to get out of it, is that because you were confident in yourself? Did you think there was somebody else looking out for you? Where was that assuredness coming from?
You're going to think I'm nuts. Everybody thinks I'm nuts, but all through my life, I've always felt that somebody's looking over you. I'm not a real religious guy, but I always felt that I got some kind of an angel that's looking out for me. And that angel is never going to let me down. I know that sounds goofy, and I don't tell that to everybody. I've always felt there's an angel. He gave me an angel. Look out for this guy. He needs a lot of help. That's what I felt. And I knew that I was going to make it out of there. There was no doubt in my mind.
I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm thinking about this. You're 18 years old. Mm-hmm. You've been in the Navy for a little over a year. Mm-hmm. And you've already been through the worst surprise attack that the American military's ever experienced. And then your ship sinking and surviving 7 hours in the water near hostile-held territory. I guess you have to believe you've got somebody looking out for you. If you're going to continue in that, that's a lot to go through as an 18-year-old.
Well, it's been through that way throughout my whole naval career, and even now. I still feel that angel is looking. How else would I be this old? Somebody's looking out for me. As I said, I'm not a religious guy. I do think there's probably a higher power, but I haven't got all the way with that yet.
And it doesn't sound like a superstition.
No, I'm not superstitious about nothing.
It's just something that you've been through enough to see it time and time again.
Yep.
Well, and if you haven't figured it out yet, maybe that's why you're still going, because there's still something to figure out.
It'll eventually come around, I think. That angel will probably say, well, you're kind of on your own now, because I got somebody else I got to worry about. So I think that'll probably happen somewhere along the line, but I'm ready for that.
You mentioned being with the Marines at Tulagi. So here, your ship's gone. It went down in flames. They've since found it. They found the wreckage down there at the bottom of
they
that
did.
Sound. Yeah, you can still
my
see
dog
the
tag is still down there in my locker, too.
So if you're listening today and you're up for an adventure, maybe you can go dive in Iron Bottom Sound off of Guadalcanal and find Bob's lost dog tag. You'll find a video of Bob explaining the dog tags he does have on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're nowhere near finished with this 26-year veteran of the U.S. Navy. Before we're done, he'll share the highlights of his honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.